Hey, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Writer Stuff Podcast. I'm Jeff Circle, and as always, the creator, head editor, everything, Mr. Writer Stuff, John Stamp is with us tonight. John, how you doing, brother?
Thank you, sir. I'm handling it.
John's got a lot going on in his life right now, everybody. But we are joined tonight, and we are very fortunate to have Elizabeth Cratched on the show tonight. Liz is a fantastic everything, and I'll start with editor or editor. Let's start there. She's a fantastic editor. She's an amazing agent, and the cool thing about Liz is she's into diving, and she lives in California and posts some fantastic pictures on social media. So if you're not following Elizabeth Cratched, K-R-A-C-H-T, you've got to look her up. And we'll provide the links here on the episode notes so that you can follow her. And Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad we could fit this in.
Thanks for joining.
Thank you for being here.
Such short notice. John and I are still working out some of the details of co-hosting, and he made the tragic mistake of giving me his Zoom login. And so I've gone in and just messed everything up week to week.
So you're saying I've been hacked? I voluntarily got hacked.
Yeah, the NSA is going to look into that for sure. Right.
Oh, they've just my research for a couple books. They've already got me on the list, the short list.
you're on the short list, all right. So Liz, man, there's so much to talk about. And first of all, we like to keep the show to like commute level length, because I love the long form podcast, but people have so much going on. Everyone's so busy. We like to keep it to, hey, you're hopping in the car. Throw it on. You're definitely going to learn something and hopefully have a little bit of fun at it. So we're going to keep this short and fun and just kind of go anywhere you want. There are really no rules here on the show. So
that sounds good.
All right. The first thing I'm going to do, people can't see here, I'm holding up the author's checklist. This book I discovered a couple years ago, grabbed it on Amazon. It came in the mail and I was working on a manuscript at the time, and it was like taking off the blinders for my writing. I thought I had a decent manuscript and it had been professionally edited. And this book, Liz, first of all, is amazing. So thank you for writing it. Second, let's talk about it a little bit. Let's get you some Christmas sales. but I'm just going to go through some things that I doggy-eared. I've got labels on different chapters. You talk about dialogue, prose, show versus tell, and voice. And so many people I run across have a little bit of trouble with voice. And everyone kind of gets it. You know, they'll read a book and it'll sound a certain way when they read it in their head, or, okay, I get that there's a certain pacing, or there's a certain character about the way this person writes. They have a lot of contractions, or they use a lot of colloquialisms, a lot of different things. And that becomes consistent with that writer. So when you pick up that book, that's their voice. But if you would tell us a little bit about what's important out of the book you wrote for voice, and how writers, which is a lot of our audience here, can benefit from really working on that voice.
I guess that you bring up a few different points. I guess the closest thing that I can kind of speak to right now is I do freelance developmental editing as well as agenting, and I keep those worlds pretty separate. And so, for example, I'm working on a project right now written by someone where the author's voice is bleeding into the fictional character or the fictional world. So I can tell by reading that this particular author has a certain skill set in terms of their life work. And sometimes that work bleeds over into the voice of the project, where the author's more concerned with getting their personal experience on the page than they are realizing that it's sort of detracting from the pacing of the project or the the story itself. And so it kind of, so there's that situation sometimes where the author bleeds through to their own work in a way that's a little too obvious and needs to be pulled back a little bit. So there's that problem, right? In terms of voice. There's also can be the problem with voice where a writer, in the same way, sort of as an author bleeding over into their own work a little bit too much, drawing from too much personal experience, there can also be situations where maybe the voice isn't right for the genre. So a writer, so that you see this a lot in young adult projects where an adult is writing a young adult book and the voice of the young adult doesn't sound like a young adult. It sounds like an adult. So they might be using words that young characters do not use, like wonderful or, you know, things like that, that where it's, this is just definitely not a 17-year-old or 16-year-old voice. And you might see that, you know, so we see a little bit of that as well, like people that are writing in a genre that, you know, isn't quite matching. I mean, a writer writing something that isn't quite matching the genre. Sometimes we'll see that in cozies and mysteries too. So a cozy voice, for example, in a mystery, in like more of a mystery. So I've run across that where, you know, a voice is very cozy. The setup for the story is very cozy with a lot of characters. There's not a lot of blood or gore, but then it kind of takes a left turn into more of a, you know, either a hard boiled mystery or it suddenly has a dark edge. So it's straddling two different genres and makes it very difficult to sell. So in terms of voice, there are a lot of different aspects to voice, which you may have noticed in the book. Sometimes I'll have a heading like voice, and then I'll address like five or six different things under the topic of voice or character.
And that's the great thing about this book. As I'm just flipping through it, you talk about author bleed in genre, like you just did. Then there's characterization, first person, and tone. But then at the end of each little section, you have a checklist, thus the name, the author's checklist, of things that go to the topic that you just wrote about. So it makes it really easy and helpful for readers to benefit from these. It's not just like, hey, I'm going to read the book and hopefully retain a little bit, maybe flip back to it. No, these are real practical ways that people can benefit from each section that maybe they need help on. If they're interested in the prose section or the dialogue section, you can hop in there and then, you know, read the narrative that you provide in little sections like you just talked about, and then go through the checklist to make sure that your manuscript is great. I think that was brilliant, a really good way to build this book out.
What you might appreciate is that checklist didn't exist before my publisher. They're like, this is a book called a checklist and there's no checklist. And I was like, okay, point well taken. And so we you know, added that like in the end, but.
No, when we talk about voice, there's, you know, when you read Crichton or you read Clancy or you read, Jack Carr, you know, that you're reading a Crichton, a Clancy, or a Carr book, or Stephen King. So there's an overall voice or tone that you know that this is this guy's style, right?
Right.
So the difference between that and keeping that overall tone of the book, but also giving each individual character their own voice and personality, the balance. Can you go a little deeper? You've got such a better eye of it being on the editor side and the agenting side, but being able to see and define that like balance that they have to keep to define their own work, but also keep those characters alive.
Right. I mean, I guess the place that I usually look for that is in dialogue, you know, oftentimes. I mean, obviously the voice of the overall project, that's, it's going to be, you know, like you said, the novel of a particular type of writer is going to have that overall narrative voice. And then, you know, that narrative voice is going to characterize the characters individually. But sometimes where you see the real difference with the characters is in the dialogue and how they, you know, what they say and how they interact, I guess. And so One thing that I would say about dialogue, which is kind of interesting, is a lot of times for me, as I run across manuscripts, it can be sometimes a little bit utilitarian, like it serves a purpose of the story. And it's not bad, but it's not unique either. And so that's something I think that a lot of people could work on, because in terms of how we communicate, oftentimes, you know, people jump in on each other before they even finish sentences, and you don't really see that active dialogue. You don't usually see that as much in manuscripts. And so I remember running across a manuscript a long time ago that had really great, unique dialogue. And it's been so long that I can't entirely remember the story now, but the dialogue was so unusual and unique that it stood out. And I don't see that often. I see dialogue that works, but sometimes it just doesn't exactly stand out. So I think writers would benefit from spending a little bit more time trying to add wit and humor to their dialogue. I'm really drawn by that, and I don't see it that often, but when I do, I love that. Just other ways that, you know, we all communicate so differently. Some of us don't communicate. That's how we communicate. And so I think like there would be a great way to distinguish the characters by how they communicate and the ways that they communicate. And a lot is communicated without saying anything at all. Right. And so, or, you know, oftentimes people say things they don't mean, of course, you know. So the narrative can help to kind of to show that in some way. But I would say, like, you know, obviously the narrative voice has to characterize the characters individually from the start of the manuscript or story. And then dialogue is often the way that we see them differentiated, I think. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, that's because when I think of that, I think Elmore Leonard, and contrasted that with Michael Crichton, because in Michael Crichton, when you read Jurassic Park, you see that every time there's a line of dialogue, it's he said, she said, they said. It's not, there's never any LYs at the end of that, you know, right, to try and put a point on that statement. And then Elmore Leonard does exactly, like, when you read Elmore Leonard's dialogue, you're reading the way people actually talk. They interrupt each other, they slang, they stumble, and they lie. And it's just, yeah. So I just, having that conversation was just, I wanted to insert and ask for myself.
That's great. That's the best, that's the best way, you know, the best.
Yeah. People will really benefit from the dialogue section here in this book too. And it covers, John, just what you said about, and Liz, you too, you know, contractions, colloquialisms, dialogue tags, you know, internal monologue, pacing, just everything. I mean, this is such a fantastic book for writers. And we have a big audience of writers. I think I'm the biggest fan of this because I benefited so much from it. But what have you heard? Some of the things that people have told you, has anyone said, hey, this changed my life, or you know, any success stories on?
I think people don't reach out too much, but I think I definitely have heard from a couple people that they've gotten agents. I mean, the book's been out since 2020, right? So unfortunately it was published right when we shut down for the pandemic. So all of my events got canceled with it. But honestly, it's all of the advice I've ever given any writer ever. Like, you know, and I think there might be one or two things that I was like, oh, I should have put that in there, but they don't stand out enough to even kind of remember what that was. But you know, one of the things that I say is that, you know, after reading so many manuscripts and working developmentally with so many writers, the reason that I wrote the book is because I noticed I was saying the same things over and over and over again, and they really didn't differ. So the advice I just sort of figured that folks would be able to kind of be like, okay, let me just think about my dialogue independently. I think a lot of us, when we go into editing our own work, we get lost in the weeds of it and we don't look at it objectively. And so the book, ideally was to help people look at their work and these individual parts like dialogue or these other areas, like, objectively and independently. So that as you start working on dialogue, you don't like suddenly start fixing your sentences, you know, like or the other narrative aspects. And you do keep focused on looking at all your dialogue. But yeah, I think there have been success stories. I don't hear too much. I mean, they're usually the reviews on Amazon. There are some good reviews there. So I think a lot of people have mentioned, you know, how it's helped them. But yeah, I would love to hear more success stories, of course, you know.
Well, I think this will help get the word out. And like I said, I need to promote it some more. I'm going to do a big deal video on it. I should have done that a long time ago. So we'll do that. But you just laid us down a great transition on agenting. And I want to ask you about, you just sold this week a true crime novel or a true crime story. What's that about?
Yeah, I had a project. In fact, I had two deals over the last three over the last 3 months, but two of them have been projects I've been working on for over 10 years. And so this is this is for all those writers out there that are like, it's never going to happen, or, you know, or my agent's terrible. She hasn't been able to sell my book. Well, sometimes things happen, you know, when the opportunity strikes, right? I've also had a project that wasn't selling. And then finally I ran across an editor who was familiar with the topic, and she was like, I want that book. And I've been trying to sell it for 2 years. So sometimes it happens like that. But this particular story is super dear to my heart. I love setting development. And so this project was set in Alaska. And it's written by a woman who is now a public, she was a public defender and now she's retired. And so she went to, she was widowed and she had to make money for her children's college. And so she decided to take a job in Alaska, the northernmost point of Alaska, which was, I think at the time it was called Barrow, but now it's maybe Utqiagvik. I think they've gone back to the original name of the town. And so she was a public defender there for 10 years. And so she defended this small community of about 3,000 people. And this particular story was about the murder of two, I think they're Inupiat sisters. And so this was the story about the person that she defended in, and it didn't end up being the person that was prosecuted, but, you know, there's some question. I think the local folks feel that the person that was that she was defending was actually the person who committed the murders, but he wasn't the one that they put on trial. So it's a great story, and it was purchased by Counterpoint, which is a great publisher, award-winning publisher. And so I'm really excited for her. She's now in her, I don't know what her age is, but she might be 80. I'm not sure, but she's very thrilled to have this book coming out, of course, and sent me flowers. And so it's been a long road for this one. I had another agent that took it out and wasn't able to sell it. And so, you know, I reached out to her. I was like, whatever happened to the book, Rebecca? And she's like, well, she wasn't able to sell it. And I was like, well, let me take another look at it, see if we can get this in shape. And then when we went out with it, we sold it. So
that's fantastic. Wow. Congratulations. Yeah. Can you tell us her name, or is it title announced, or where are we on that?
Her name is Rebecca Wright Stevens, and she is currently, I believe, in Tennessee. Okay. And yeah, and so the title of the book right now is Who Killed the Apollo Sisters? Okay. But I think that may change. Sure. It's had the title, you know, this is something that your agent and authors do, is we go back and forth on titles. And this title was never one that we were necessarily able to kind of like, you know, solidify. So we were going to call it, I think at one point, the title we were calling it Midnight, like Murder Under the Midnight Sun, because one of the interesting things about this particular story is that nobody could remember the last time they saw the sisters, because the sun was shining for days and days straight. And so it became a big part of the story. So that was kind of one of the titles. But then, of course, True Detective came out, right?
That's right, the Inter-Alaska one.
Right. And so some things have like kind of influence title changes and things like that. So I'm not sure that Who Killed the Apollock Sisters is going to stay, but for right now, that's kind of the working title. I have a feeling it'll get changed.
Well, hey,
there's no better. Oh, go ahead.
Oh no, and there's no better what?
Yeah. There's just no better endorsement for the grind of getting published than that story right there. I mean, yeah. Her story alone, you know, being a public defender in a 3,000 person town probably led to some tense moments, but grinding it out 10 years, just trying to sell it. That's just the way it works. And everybody wants it right now, you know?
Yeah, it's so true. And I think the beautiful thing about that story is that she was really embraced by the culture there. You know, she was a white woman and she defended the community and I don't know. And that's what's so unusual about the story. It's just, it's just a great story, I think. But also to your point about the grind, you know, nowadays I think writers, they're kind of impatient, right? I'm going to self-publish, you know? Yeah. And so not everybody is willing to wait 10 years for their story to come out. And in fact, I was just working with someone who's kind of like a minor celebrity and they're like, I don't want to wait. I have to get the story out. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, we're under contract for a year, but okay. You know, so it just, you know, we don't want to keep anyone. We don't want anyone to be miserable. And so I think, I just think it's that kind of time where everybody gets to decide, do I want to wait? Do I care about traditional publishing? Not everybody does. So not everybody feels like they need to be published by, you know, Penguin Random House or whatever, but that's always our goal for you or for writers, you know, to start at the top and see what happens.
Well, hey, when it comes to being an agent and working with writers like this book is obviously a passion project for everybody. How much of your personal connection did you put into this project, or how much do you look for that when you decide who you might want to editorially develop with? Because in this instance, your father was a homicide detective.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have an ancillary connection to the whole justice community and law enforcement and everything. And John can talk a lot about this too with his law enforcement background. Did that help you put your teeth into it and just really, you know, press the gas to move this forward because of, you know, how you understood the justice system to roll?
Well, what's interesting being in publishing, so this is going to be a little bit of a long-winded answer, but being in publishing, what I found really interesting is that I have been pitched books by public defenders in the past. And I've, being on the homicide detective daughter's side, I've always been like, I don't know about that. I just don't understand it. Like why, you know, and I've met, like, I remember being in Montana actually at a conference and I met a public defender and she said, she was a criminal defense attorney. I think she was a public defender. I'm not sure. She might've been in private practice, but she goes, I really found my soul, you know, becoming a criminal defense attorney. And I was like, that just sounds that how is that possible? Like, I just couldn't understand that perspective. And this has happened about a few times at least. And so I've really tried to understand what that is, because just from my perspective, I just couldn't understand it. And what I think I've come away with is what was happening for some of those folks when they are on the prosecutorial side is that they didn't feel like they saw the individual or the person. And usually what was behind the individual and the person is maybe a lot of difficulty in life, you know, that, and some wrong turns that ended them, you know, that they got into the situation that they were in. And so they all seemed to feel like they got their humanity back when they started doing public defense work. And so I thought that was really interesting. And Rebecca she's just a very interesting person and her perspective. I think that's why this book is so interesting, because her perspective is really interesting and her care and feeling that everybody deserves to be represented and to be, seen as innocent until proven guilty, right? And so that's been, you know, it's been interesting, and it has been like this kind of personal, I don't know, I've taken it personally to try to better understand that perspective. And then I think in terms of us taking on projects that have some kind of personal connection, because what we do for a living as agents is a pretty much like hustling for a living. So like, I'm kind of a gambler, right? I don't get paid until you get paid. So I can put 10 years of my time and energy into a project and never get paid for it, right? And so it's really important for us to take on projects that we are passionate about or that we do feel some connection to. So I would say for most of my projects, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, there is some interest. Once in a while, I'll take on something where I'm like, I'm not really sure, but I have a feeling that this is, you know, this person is hot topic or this topic is, you know, of interest right now. But in general, there's always some kind of personal connection. And then, of course, because my dad was a homicide detective, true crime or crime stories are sort of that place I go to when, you know, you curl up on the couch, or even when you're kind of, you know, it used to be that kind of way to get home, you know, like, I don't know what, I'm kind of at a loss for words, but it's sort of like a comfort zone.
It's funny. Whenever my wife's the same way, we put a true crime drama on and it like settles her to sleep. Like I could not tell you like how that works, but I imagine, for you, it's kind of like you're watching the detective's work. It was like, oh, you just feel a little sense of community. And I'm watching it like trying to, you know, just think of, man, I wish I was that good, or I wish I had thought of something like that. And I look over there and she's just like, she's just settled right into the nap. I was like, they're talking about butchering people. How are you falling asleep right now?
Well, the funny thing is my dad won't watch true crime. Like, he's like, why are you guys watching true crime? It's morbid. I'm like, Dad, like, you know, you were a homicide detective. Like, so he won't watch true crime at all. I mean, I think he will get into some of these new Netflix ones, but generally that's not where he goes, but he does watch all kinds of detective, you know, foreign and domestic detective thriller stories. So,
well, that's, I mean, crime.
That's funny. That's funny you mentioned that. And that, and Circle, I can't watch like NCIS or FBIs or the CSIs. I just can't handle it. But I'll watch like 48 Hours and OP Live like a hawk, because I'm watching it as like a student trying to like get better at my game. Like, you know, it's weird, but I can't watch the fictionalized stuff. Yeah.
Well, you probably see a lot of mistakes in the fictionalized stuff too, right? The weapons are wrong, or the, you know, my client PJ is always doing that, because he's in the Air Force. He's a colonel in the Air Force now, and he just sees all the he'll go to writers' conferences and they'll have weapons expert panels, and he'll be like, you know. He's like,
every
that's
time,
not how that goes, huh?
Every time there's something on TV with a polygraph, my wife will tell you, I usually end up throwing something at the TV because it's always wrong. And having a background in that, I'm just like, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this show sucks. So,
and I mean, me and Jeff were on the phone, what was it, last week or the weekend? And he goes, what's wrong with this passage? And he was like, he unholstered his Glock 19 and cocked back the hammer. And I'm like, just shut the book. Just shut
Liz,
the book.
It was
page there's one. No hammer, right?
I can't. I was like,
I did a video. It's a 2-minute video on my YouTube channel about that, where I read the passage. I'm like, my thumb pulling back the hammer of my Glock, and I'm like, page two, Liz, shut the book. I'm sorry. I couldn't. Yeah. You lost me. Yeah, I mean, so this author is writing about a detective. And on page one, if they do something like that, I'm like, how can I take anything that you say about a detective and their decisions and their process and what's going to happen if you can't get the gun right. And the Glock, it's not like, oh, I pulled out the, you know, a really obscure German, you know, version. No, it's a Glock. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, it's simplicity personified. But you mentioned the how we can't watch the fictionalized stuff. So at my house, it's almost impossible for TV because I can't watch the NCIS, the FBI, the CSIs, and she can't watch. She's a surgical nurse. She can't watch the Grey's Anatomies, the Chicago Meds, ER, stuff like that, because she'll start freaking out about the way somebody's wearing a mask or putting on their gloves. And it's like, I just let's just watch a cartoon. I don't know. So like Transformers funny. From the 80s. I don't know.
That's funny. I love it.
Well, Liz, we're getting here close to the end of the commute. We've talked about Liz, the developmental editor, Liz, the author, with some great advice, a little bit about your aging, but I want to jump in real quick with for the audience that are writers or anyone interested in this process. As an agent, you are constantly sifting through things that you both want to have a passion for, but find something that you also think, hey, this is actually going to sell. It might not be my area, but I know this is the hot thing right now. So when people craft their queries to go to you, I'll hit you with two questions. How do you like the format of the query to be so that hopefully our listeners who write you will get it easy and make it easy for you? How do you want that query letter crafted? And give me a don't.
Nice.
So I might be the dinosaur of agents or one of them, because I still accept submissions through email and not through a submittable form. So if you have listeners, so for any of your listeners that want to submit to me, if you go onto my website, I'm closed for submissions unless I do things like this. Or I do conferences. So anybody who's lucky enough to hear your podcast, if they want to submit to me, they can. My email is liz@kimberlycameron.com. You won't find that on the website though, so I'll just put that out there to any writers that want to submit.
Oh, our episode just went viral, everybody.
That'd be a good metric.
But it's for anyone smart, and I'm pretty nice. So anybody who's smart enough to figure out my thing, I would never send anybody away. But I would say the rule of thumb with agents is it's good, I guess, that people see them as mean or strict or whatever, because in a way it keeps everybody's game a little higher. I don't mind so much if things come to me in a way that are, not, really buttoned up, I guess, or even if they submit to me and I'm closed. Right. So for me, people can just submit by email with a query in the body of the email. Ideally, as mentioned, that I've talked about in my book, it's going to be, you don't want the agent to have to scroll too much because we read for a living. So straight to the point business letter almost is what we're looking for, with some comp titles, the title of your book, the word count, and a summary. Usually it's third person present when you're writing a fiction summary. If it's nonfiction, it can be a little bit different, right? They can be a little longer. And I look at both fiction and nonfiction. So I have a wide, my boss and I both have a really wide range of projects that we'll look at. So I just kind of need it to be kept simple, almost like a business email. But the most important rule of thumb with agents is following the guidelines of the agency. So every agent is going to have guidelines and they're going to want things very specifically. And so the most important thing is to follow what they are doing or what they're asking for. So mine can come in by email. I'm pretty relaxed and, I like being nudged, because sometimes as Jeff knows, I forget, or I have a lot of things going on personally. And so I need, I need that nudge to keep on track. But basically I would just follow the agency guidelines to the letter. And sometimes you're going to be submitting only a query letter. They're not going to let you submit pages. So you want that query letter to be tight. I do have a course coming up through Book Passage Bookstore about how to write one, but keep crafting that so your query letter is just sharp. And the summary is probably always the hardest part for people, I think, to get that to get that detailed enough. And then, you know, just follow everything that's being asked of you. And sometimes you may have the opportunity to send 10 pages or 50 pages. Obviously, you want to make sure those are passed by, you know, either a professional or someone you really trust as a beta reader. So I think your submission materials are pretty important, not for somebody who's lax like me, but you should assume that nobody's like me, right? And and just really tighten that query letter. And I guess the don't would be don't try to send it out to a chain. You'll get deleted if you submit it to 100 agents in one email chain. Or if you fall on the side of being overly, we get some pretty intense query letters, like overly confident query letters. Or on the flip side, sometimes when you start out saying, I'm not a writer, but I wrote this book, you like, so you don't want to be, you don't want a lack of confidence either. You just want to come in like your, you know, business letter writing skills. You know, here's my project. This is what it's about. These are the comp titles. And this is a little bit about me. And that's all you need, really. The more straightforward, the better.
Awesome. I love it.
You've had somebody submit to like 100 people at once?
It happens all the time. You know,
and really?
And usually some agents ever respond, you know. But
do you ever see like, where did I rank? Like, where was I? Was I top 10? Am I 20, top 25?
Right. No, I've never looked at that, but that would be interesting. But they just, they hit you and we just delete those. Once maybe I've responded to one, you know, but usually if somebody's doing that, their materials aren't very good either because they haven't done the homework to at least understand how the industry likes to be approached. Right. So like even I'm trying to get more knowledge about film and TV industry personally, but I'm going to do my homework to figure out how it wants to be approached, you know, and they're different than book publishing. Book publishing is so much easier as compared to film and TV that has so many different players. And, but I'm going to do my homework on how they like to be approached. Cause I'm not just going to go in there kind of bumbling around.
You know? Hey, well, after this episode, I'll give you Taylor Sheridan's phone number. You can text him.
Great. So
he just wrapped one up. He should be open for business, right?
So I think, I guess those would be, you know, the submission materials are important, you know, especially if you've only got a short window to get through the door. And actually going to writers' conferences, I think that's a really smart way to get in front of agents. And there's another one, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Chuck Sambaccino. He used to be with Writer's Digest, but now he does these writer's retreat, or he calls them writing workshops, and they're usually all online, and he brings in like 25 agents. And so you can get in front of an agent in your living room or several of them. And so I always suggest, I think I've written him into the book because there are a couple people that work specifically with writers like that, that they just, you know, when you can get in front of 20 agents in, you know, the course of a day, like that's a goal, that's gold. Right. For any writer, I think, because it makes a difference meeting people in person, you know?
Yeah, that's good.
All right. There's a plug for Thriller Fest and Pitch Fest. Get out there. People. Yeah, there we go. Got my hat. Got my Thriller Fest hat. No, that's where we met. No, you're right. It'll help give everybody some confidence and learn the process and just go with it. So, John, you got anything, Liz, that's all I have. I wanted to get into the diving and the yoga and the meditation. I really like your approach to everything that you do. You seem really balanced. I think people would really benefit from, you know, your book and talking to you. So anyone out there get a chance to link up with Liz at a conference somewhere, definitely take advantage of it.
Yeah. We'll do the diving and the meditation in part two.
Part two? Coming up.
Part two.
All right. Yeah. Well, Liz, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Especially at last minute like this, we wanted to have you on, and I want to do a dossier on you too down the road. We'll get that done after the holidays, but thanks so much for joining us. This is great.
You know, one thing I just wanted to say about that too is you never know, you know, like it just takes an email, right? And someone could be available, and sometimes that's how it works. There was one person recently, I think it was a screenwriter, who basically said, that, you know, if you have one and two in play, then it makes the opportunity for number three to come along, right? So like just sending an email sometimes and making the connection. So, you know, we've connected in the past, we're connecting now, and who knows what's going to happen in the future, right? So I think it's great, you know, just to keep networking and to keep, you know, trying to connect with people in the industry.
Well, you're killing the segues. It's perfect. You're wonderful, guys. I was just going to ask, how do people connect with you? I know you're on social media. We follow each other, but if you know off the top of your head what your handles are, if you can share some of those with people, they can follow you too.
Yeah, I think my one on X is at Elizabeth hyphen Crocked, and then maybe some at Elizabeth Crocked on Instagram. I'm really not on social media as much as I should be. I'm mostly on Facebook, so people can come find me on Facebook, and I pretty much allow everyone if I don't think you're a fake profile. And then I have a website, elizabethcrocked.com and kimberlycameron.com, which is my agency. So you can find me in any and all of those places, and then conferences. So I'll be at Thriller Fest this coming May. I'm not sure if I'll be there in person or just virtually. And then I think I'm going to participate in the San Francisco Writing Workshop, which is maybe in April.
Oh,
I think
cool.
It's in April. So
there you go, Northern California.
Yeah.
Busy.
But I usually promote those things when I'm doing them. So
super.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nice.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody. And that's all I've got. John?
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for joining us, Liz.
All right. Thanks.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.